Welcome to Forward. I'm your host, Allison Innes. Have you ever experienced a concussion, or perhaps you know somebody who has? Traumatic brain injuries can cause a whole host of symptoms, ranging from concentration and memory problems to problems with sleep and mood and vision. These symptoms are often invisible and can last anywhere from days to years. And it's difficult for other people to understand what someone's going through. My guest today, Mike Griffin, has worked with students to bring that experience to the stage in his recent production of The Mysterious Mind of Molly McGillicuddy, performed in February 2024 at the Merlin I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts. Mike is a lecturer with the Department of Dramatic Arts, affectionately known as DART. He received the Faculty of Humanities 2023 Excellence in Teaching Award in recognition of his work helping students discover their creative voices. Mike has worked in universities, schools, and theater companies across Canada as a theater educator, writer, and director. He researches and teaches the theater form Commedia dell'arte, which flourished in Italy from the 16th to 18th centuries and is characterized by the use of masks. The Mysterious Mind of Molly McGillicuddy is not Mike's first DART main stage, as he also wrote and directed Pantalone's Palace in the fall 2017. I spoke with Mike about his work on The Mysterious Mind of Molly McGillicuddy shortly before its opening night.
I teach movement and mask and acting. I also teach directing, and we have a fourth year capstone course, which essentially the collective of students works together to create new theater. And so I've done that a couple of years. That's one of the courses I'm teaching this year, which is a really exciting course that the students sort of get to bring in all of their experience of, you know, whether they're designers or directors or actors, and we sort of create a mini theater company and create new theater, which is really exciting.
So we are talking at the very end of January, mm-hmm. and your production is coming up very, very soon. I think the 18th, is that right?
The 15th.
The 15th? Yeah. Even sooner.
15th to the 18th. Yeah.
15th to the 18th. Yeah. I think this is really interesting, and I'll put a link in the show notes to the Brock News story that just came out about it, but it is called The Mysterious Mind of Molly McGillicuddy,
yeah.
which is a fantastic name, but I understand you wrote this
yes.
as well, and you are producing it and obviously working with the students. So that sounds like a massive project. Where did you come up with the original idea, and why brain injury?
So I come from a place of having experienced a brain injury, and as I was kind of on my long road of recovery, I decided that one of the things that I wanted to explore was creating around the issue of brain injury. As a theater maker, you know, I wanted to come from a place of like, you know, what can I bring to the world and what stories might not be commonly told. And so brain injury is not a topic that's often talked about. I mean, often we think of concussions and brain injury as things that are, you know, that happen to athletes and happens for a couple of days and they're playing back on Sunday or whatever it might be. So I think one of the things was I was really curious is to try to give a little bit more awareness of you know, some of the things that people experience when they receive a concussion, and so because I came from an experience of receiving a concussion and then being off work for a significant time and really struggling with that experience, I wanted to see if I could create something around that. So I started with this idea, and as it sort of evolved, I was running a number of workshops with students, and I realized that as I was writing, that the play needed to be a nonverbal play.
I was going to ask you about that, because I'm not sure if that makes the writing process easier or harder.
You know what? I mean, in some ways a little easier, but in many ways very much harder. because I have to essentially envision everything as I'm writing. When you look at the script on the page, it's really stage directions, you know, it's outlining all of the events, the actions that are taking place on stage. And so it's a very different process than trying to find the right dialogue and, you know, trying to develop characters through what they say. So, yeah, I mean, so we're working in mask, physical theater, and different styles of movement. And so one of the challenges with this project is essentially to tell the story through the body versus through the text. So, yeah, it's been an adventure. It was definitely an ambitious project, and I think it's going really well so far. So I'm excited to have it open in a couple weeks here.
Excellent. Now I want to come back and talk about masks in a little bit, because mm-hmm. I know you've done quite a bit of work around masks. But in terms of developing this play with the students, like, at what point do the students get involved in it? Like, do you present it to them, this is what we're doing, and learn your parts? Or is it a more collaborative approach for students? What is it like for them?
So there's been three phases in this project, and every project's a bit different. But when I knew that this was what I wanted to do, I gathered a handful of students, and they worked with me for a couple of months. Just I think it was around six sessions that we had. And so we would have like a 4-hour session, and I would come and I would bring ideas to the group. And then we would start to improvise around these ideas and explore different ways to approach things. Like, one of the things that we really engaged in was like the inner physiology of the brain and what happens when the brain breaks down and what might that look like. How can we sort of stage the invisible or the microscopic kind of things that are occurring? And so I worked with these students. Basically, you know, we kind of worked just as collaborators, and I would bring some text at times and we would stage it, or we would work off an idea and improvise around that. And so that was kind of stage one. And then stage two came after I had done some more writing, and we spent the better part of a week diving into the play and looking at the characters and, again, exploring some of the sequences. And really that time was about me kind of testing, you know, what I had written. Will this work on stage? So I had around eight students who were working with me there, just to kind of like test it out, you know, is this idea, you know, are these sort of individual scenes going to work out? And then from there, then I dove back into writing, and then essentially I created like a rehearsal draft, and then we've started rehearsals. And so within rehearsals, myself and my assistant director, who's a student, and my dramaturg, who's a colleague of mine, we will see moments where things need to shift and change. Like last weekend, we had a run, and then I went home and realized that a whole bunch of stuff needed to change. So essentially I sort of changed the order of a bunch of scenes and chopped up some scenes. And so, yeah, it's been a really unique experience, because the students have been really open to like knowing that changes will occur because it's a new play. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and so now we're kind of in the polishing process, with only a couple of weeks away of just getting things, you know, where we want them to be, and working towards performing them in front of an audience.
So what can a visitor, an attender, mm-hmm. attendee, I guess, at the play, what can they expect? Like, is it going to be like a narrative arc that they might recognize, or is it like, what does the story kind of look like?
Yeah. So essentially we start with the lead character of Molly pre-concussion, and then we experience the concussion with Molly. And then it's kind of the journey back to, back to sort of a healed place. I think one of the realities of my experience and many folks who have experienced a concussion is that when you have a brain injury, you're never really like the same. You know, it's not like coming back to who I was. It's sort of engaging with who who I am now or the version of me that presents itself now. So one of the things that we are playing with is the healing process isn't linear. Mm-hmm. And so it's not kind of, you know, accident and then sort of a rising healing, you know, and then everything's fine. But I think the journey of the play shows how there's ups and downs and how things are unexpected, and you might have a really good day and then the next day you might be completely drained. So yeah, I think that it's quite an adventure for an audience. We're working in a world that is very whimsical and very heightened. So when you look at a moment like experiencing symptoms like dizziness or brain fog or things like that, what we've tried to do is stage those things in a theatrical way, because those are things that are happening, you know, within, you know, one individual, and, you know, things as well, like mental health issues, which is really connected to the experience of a brain injury. So all of those things we're trying to amplify and heighten in a way that an audience will experience and try to get them to understand what it's like, versus going back to like just telling them what it's like. So even though we're very conscious of the fact that some people would be quite sensitive to elements like flashing lights or loud sounds, in some moments of the play those things are quite necessary for us to communicate how things feel from the perspective of Molly, the character who's experienced this.
Yeah, I want to ask about that, because one of the things that you've done with this play that I think is really interesting and very exciting is you've kind of thought through what would it be like for somebody with a concussion to watch this play, mm-hmm. and how to make it accessible. So I understand that you've got like some screening, there's some virtual, like there's different options for how people want to engage with it.
Yeah, so we've got, aside from just coming and buying your ticket and coming to see the show, we've got three different options. And so one of those is on the Sunday matinee performance, we're doing what's called a relaxed performance. And a relaxed performance is something that theater companies do to really support accessibility, often for, you know, folks who might be neurodivergent and folks who might not be able to handle the intensity of a normal theater experience, whether that's crowd size or whether that's, you know, lighting or sound or anything like that. Whether that's even just sitting in your seat and having to sort of deal with the rules of the theater. And so the way that we're approaching this relaxed performance is that some of the lights and sounds, like those cues, will be adjusted. The actors will come out and talk, you know, and introduce themselves at the very beginning of the play before we start, so that folks can see, you know, the individual behind, you know, behind the mask. No metaphor intended there. And then we will also have a room where if being in the theater is too much, that folks can go into this sort of cozy, comfy room and also watch the play that will be streamed, you know, on a screen within that room, and we'll lay out some mats and, you know, people can sort of lie down or sit, you know. And so that's one way that we're trying to connect to embracing the fact that everybody's coming from different experiences. Another element is that we're streaming one of our performances, the Saturday night performance, will be streamed so that let's say that I have just received a concussion and I want to view this because I'm interested in the content, but going to a theater, being around people, maybe it's even like getting to the theater might be overwhelming. And so now you can watch it, you know, in the comfort of your own home and adjust lighting or sound however you need to adjust. And then the third sort of option is we've got a student, Rebecca Cohen, who has been working with us to create a gallery in response to the production. And so Rebecca has has drawn a number of images that respond to kind of the different ideas and moments of the play in a way that you could come and, you know, go through the gallery and sort of take in the major ideas of the play, you know, if all of those other options, you know, felt like they were too much to deal with.
So what are you hoping that viewers, however they choose to engage with it, mm-hmm. What are you kind of hoping they come away with?
I think part of it is, you know, maybe an appreciation and a bit more knowledge about what is actually happening within someone who has received a brain injury. The idea of the sort of the invisible injury is something that we've really drawn to, or we've been really drawn to in this experience. And so allowing people to see and to feel what's happening inside. Looking at different kinds of symptoms and different kinds of moments that for somebody looking from the outside, you know, it would just seem like they're fine. You know, this is something that I experienced when I was sort of in the heat of my concussion is, you know, people would say, well, you look fine. So I think that, I think that is a larger thing that really connects to things like mental health as well. You know, hey, everybody looks fine. They don't have a cast or they don't have a cut or something like that that says I'm injured. But when we're dealing with the brain, when we're dealing with mental health, those things are very real. And so to try to just open up people's awareness of trying to understand that when someone says, hey, I'm dealing with this, I'm going through these symptoms, that's, you know, that's very real. I think a little bit of just, you know, awareness. I think that I know for myself, you know, I grew up in sort of a sports background, and a concussion was something that, you know, you were told to kind of just like shake off.
I remember those days.
Yeah.
And yeah, you went back to class, or you sat, you know, it wasn't a serious injury.
Yeah.
Whereas now they're calling them traumatic brain injuries.
Yeah.
Because they are.
Yeah.
Injuries.
Yeah. I mean, I think any injury to the brain is a traumatic injury, you know. And I think that for me, not only because I've experienced this myself, but every year I would say that I see about 3 students who experience a concussion. And for some, it might just be, you know, they miss a class and they're back and everything's, you know, seems to be normal. And for some of them, it's, you know, it's months. Mm-hmm. And maybe they have to leave school. Maybe they have to, you know, they start to really struggle in their classes. Like, all of those things are very much around us. I would say that most of us have probably know or have experienced a concussion, you know, or know someone who has. And so, yeah, I think that it's about awareness. It's about sort of opening our eyes a little bit. And it's also about telling a story that I think is really important, but also is not necessarily voiced very often, which is also funny because I'm not voicing anything. but I mean, you know.
You're still telling
yeah.
the story. So one of the really interesting things too, especially with a topic like that, but like in humanities in general, is that what we do intersects with so many other things out in
Absolutely.
The world. And so this is a topic that obviously is going to intersect with other fields of study.
Yeah.
With physiologists and scientists and athletes and that kind of thing. So you
mm-hmm.
mentioned you've got a research panel coming up?
Yeah, we've got an event coming up this week that explores, we're bringing in a couple of different pieces of art that have been created from artists who have experienced concussions. So I'm going to be sharing a little bit about Molly, and then I've got another colleague who's coming in with a film that explores her experience of a concussion, and then we've got another a group that's coming in with a sort of a shorter chunk of a larger piece that's a musical piece specifically written for the bass clarinet. And so basically we're going to start with exploring and sharing these different creative pieces. And then we've got a panel that will respond to those pieces. So we've got a panel of a couple of colleagues from the university in different departments as you're talking about the intersectionality of this. And then we've also got the CEO of Ontario Brain Injury Association, and then some folks from Active Life Rehab Plus, which is a concussion management physiotherapy clinic. And so, yeah, it's going to be this really interesting kind of conversation of observing work, art that's been created in response to brain injury, and then linking that in with you know, the research and practice of dealing with brain injuries. So
yeah, I guess it's one thing to talk about our brains or our bodies kind of in terms of cells and hormones and all the magical things. They seem magical, I'm not a scientist, but all of those little bits, but then also to be able to bring into that the experience and expression of the experience, because it is such a variable experience.
Mm-hmm.
And no two concussions are the same.
Yeah.
Even if it's the same person, right?
Yeah.
So you've mentioned that this is something that comes out of your own experience.
Mm-hmm.
with concussion. So I just wanted to take a minute and just ask you about what that's like when you're dealing with something that's so personal.
Mm.
To yourself, but you're making this really public, right?
Yeah.
What is that process like?
I mean, vulnerable.
A little bit scary.
Definitely scary. And I think that this is a play that I'm so invested in. And so there's a different level of anxiety that connects with that. But I would also say that this has been one of the most fulfilling, like, experiences of creating something that I've ever gone through. And part of that is the freedom that comes with being able to play with the ideas and experiences that you've gone through yourself. Additionally, though, this isn't the Mike Griffin story. I want to make that really clear. I think that some scenes are, you know, might have an inspiration from my experience, but I've done a lot of research that has assisted with fueling the ability to tell a different story. And so this very much is, you know, the story of Molly McGillicuddy versus myself. And so that was important for me to have that little bit of distance so that that element of the vulnerability wasn't that I was just telling my own story. You know, which is very much, you know, many people will do, you know, create plays around their own tales, but
mm-hmm.
For me, I felt that I needed to have a little bit of separation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems to me that this is something that perhaps is a bit more common in the arts in general, in performing arts, visual arts, musical arts, even, that it's that research comes from a personal place or it's a bit more personal. That sometimes, not all the times, but sometimes that we maybe don't think about in other disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're writing a paper about something about the 18th century, it might not feel quite as personal as
yeah.
when you're, like, really engaging with and reflecting on your
mm-hmm.
thoughts and feelings and experiences.
Yeah, and I think that my personal experience has allowed me to dive into a set of research that's very vast, you know, as I've created this play. I mean, I didn't know all about the science of things and the, you know, the internal physiology before I started working on the play. I would say, actually, in many ways, you know, I would go to my concussion physiotherapists and we would talk about what was happening, but I was also concussed, and so I wasn't necessarily retaining all of that information. And so when I started creating and my head was a little bit clearer, I was starting to be like, oh yeah, that's something that I connected to, you know, quite a long time ago, but I didn't really understand it. You know, that's something that someone told me that I didn't really understand. For instance, there's a theory called spoon theory, which has been a real inspiration for the piece. And so Spoon Theory essentially comes out of this idea that we wake up in the morning and we all have like a certain amount of spoons. And then when, you know, when something is fairly taxing, that takes away our spoons, you know, or take, let's say, it, you know, I go do laundry. And for someone who hasn't experienced a concussion or hasn't, you know, isn't in a place of injury or illness, you know, maybe that doesn't even take any spoons. But for someone who is really battling, that might like take away three spoons. And then I might have like a conversation with my neighbor and that takes away, you know, another two spoons. And so it's this kind of process of gaining and losing spoons. And sometimes it's, you know, it's 11:30 a.m. and all my spoons are gone. And how am I going to get through the rest of the day? And so that has been a really interesting piece of research that I connected with in this process that has inspired quite a large sequence in the play, which is titled Spoons. And it kind of runs like this fun sort of video game, which is kind of, you know, you think about the energy elements that, you know, you have on a video game and you get like knocked and like there goes your, you know, part of your energy and that kind of thing. So
we'll put a link to that in the website. That's a theory that I've seen as well and is quite an active or used to be anyway, in various Twitter and social media mm-hmm. spheres, kind of the community that sprung up around that, mm-hmm. that idea. So we'll put a link in the show notes if that's resonating with anybody and they want to read a little bit more about that. I'm very excited to see this play and see how it resonates with my own experiences yeah. as well and gain some insight, hopefully. Concussion research has definitely come a long way, mm-hmm. You know, just in the past 5 or 10 years. And like you were saying, you know, it used to be, again, associated with athletes primarily,
yeah.
but hopefully this kind of helps shift that needle and just mm-hmm. how easy it is. It can happen to anybody and those consequences can last a lifetime.
Yeah. I think too that, I mean, many of my students remark that even though they haven't necessarily experienced a concussion, some of them are coming from places of chronic illness or other injuries, and that some of the experiences that we talk about in the play are things that they really connect to, even not having come from a place of brain injury. And so that, I think, is something that that I'm really excited to sort of hear what the audience response is. You know, there's obviously the connection of folks who have experienced a concussion, but you know, other people too who deal with illness and injury and the frustrations of you know, of those things. I think is it makes this this a really unique experience.
Definitely. So I did mention I wanted to come back to masks, mm-hmm. and you're using masks in this play,
yeah.
But you've been working with masks for a while. So how did you get interested in masks? And we're not talking about the ones we've been wearing for COVID, although I suppose...
Yeah, that's always, I always have to clarify that when I'm talking to people.
We're talking about theatrical masks,
yeah.
And listeners will know my background in classics, so I'm familiar with, you know, that's kind of my context for masks in theater. But how did you get interested in it?
I mean, I was really fortunate when I was doing my undergrad at UBC to experience a Commedia dell'arte class. Commedia dell'arte, which is an Italian form of mask theater. So I, you know, throughout the years, was always interested in this style, and that kind of evolved into other forms of mask, like we're experiencing, which is a full mask theater, more specifically full character masks. So as I was doing my training, and I did my master's exploring Commedia dell'arte, and trained in Italy in this kind of theater. And then that kind of just kept branching. I was just really interested in how how masks were a way for actors to find character in a different kind of way. And one thing that was really interesting was that when an actor put on a mask, often you would think that the mask is this sort of fixed element, but in really strong mask performance, like the mask starts to fade away, and you can just imagine the character. You start to see the actor less and less. And that kind of transformative nature was something that I was really interested in, both as an instructor of acting, but also as a performer and creator. So, I mean, one of my specializations is in this commedia dell'arte, this Italian style of mask theater, but I also teach here other forms of mask, so neutral mask, which is one form, or character half mask or character full mask, and these styles of mask come from, you know, a number of different kinds of places, but I would say that the at the heart of them is this this ability to transform into character through using the mask as an inspiration. And so with this project, as we were developing everything, we were working with mask and seeing like, wow, what would this mask be like for this character? And, bringing in different kinds of masks to try to test out the moments as well. And then I've also been through this process. I knew that I didn't have a mask that would suit a couple of the characters, and so part of my research over the last year has been in mask making. And so so there's three masks in the play that I've made, and that's been a real challenging and interesting journey for me.
How do you make a mask?
That's a really great question.
The only masks I'm familiar with are like the plaster of Paris,
sure,
kind of things that you do when you're in grade school.
Yeah. So there's two different styles of mask making that you'll see in the show. One is, both have been sculpted by clay, and then one of them has comes from creating a silicone mold from the clay, silicone and then plaster on top of that. And then within that, you basically paper mache the inside. And so the paper mache gets pulled from the mold, and then you paint it and finish it and everything like that. So that's one form. And then the other form is with clay, and then pouring a mold, and then pouring neoprene, which is like a form of plastic, into the mold, letting that sit for a little while, and then essentially pouring the rest of the neoprene out. So it kind of creates this film on the outside of the mold that essentially becomes the mask, and then you let that dry and again paint and put straps on it and all of the stuff that takes lots of time.
So were students involved in that phase at all, or?
I had students involved in sort of the inspiration of it, but because of the amount of hours, I probably for each mask, it's been at least 40 hours worth of time to put into each mask, possibly more. So it just wasn't super feasible in having having them be part of that creation process. And also, I'm doing this in my basement, so, have to have some barriers there.
Yeah, of course.
But the mask specifically for Molly and for the character of M, which is Molly sort of post-concussion, and then the character of Baby God, I asked the actors to like send me inspirations of how they envisioned like how the character would look. And so, I had those pictures up on my wall as I was sculpting and everything. So
do you tend to reuse masks kind of from production to production, or are they kind of made for this production and that's it?
So we are really lucky that we have a stock of masks in the theater department here, which I often teach with in my second year class. And so a lot of the masks that we're using are from that stock. And so those ones would be reused. The ones that are being made specifically for the show, I'm not sure necessarily if those would end up becoming reused, but we would add them to sort of either my stock of masks personally, or to the department stock of masks. So I think it's interesting to to think about like the journey of a mask and how it might, you know, start with one production and then it might turn into something completely different. So I'm interested to see where these, I keep pointing over here because that's where they are. Of course, you know, listeners can't see
maybe
that.
Maybe we'll get a picture to share with our listeners. Yeah. That's really interesting. And just while you were talking, I was thinking about how like my association with masks, and certainly I'm sure it's influenced by COVID, that there's something you hide behind, there's something mm-hmm. that cover up. We often talk about masking or hiding behind a mask or taking somebody's mask off in a metaphorical yeah. sense of hiding. But it sounds like masks can be a way of bringing out and revealing.
Absolutely.
Just as much.
Yeah, I think that there's a really beautiful way of revealing vulnerability too. I mean, I think that sometimes students are very reserved and then they put a mask on and all of a sudden that like something opens up inside of them, which I think is really exciting. I think that really strong mask work will always show the heart of like what's underneath the mask. And, you know, some people may look at the masks lying on a table and think they look like cartoons or something like that. But I think that what we're trying to achieve with this production is that we really see that there's layers, right? That even though the mask will have like a fixed expression, that actually can change through the body, you know, positions and that kind of thing, or like shifting the mask different kinds of ways. So I think that in that there's like a real interesting sort of vulnerability and an interesting way of like opening up to the audience.
Yeah. And just speaking of students and vulnerability, I've never done drama, or dramatic arts, but, it seems to me from what I've seen of it is that, it requires a lot of vulnerability from students, and that there's a lot of emphasis here placed on having collaborative spaces where students can explore and contribute and feel safe and recognized with that.
Absolutely, yeah. I think our department's really, I think that's one of the things that makes our department really special, is that that it's not just about learning like how to act or how to write about theater or how to design for theater, but I think that it's about how we explore humanity, you know? It's about how we explore ourselves. I mean, one of the most exciting things in my job is to not only see someone like grow as a performer throughout the 4 years that I work with them, but also just growing as a human being and developing their confidence and developing their own voice and all of those things I think are such incredible sort of additions to just the general, you know, education that they receive here.
Yeah, and you recently received an award for your teaching. Yeah. I say recently, it was back in the spring, back in June, mm-hmm. at Convocation, so not that recently, I guess, but it feels recent.
I mean, we're getting close to another Convocation here soon, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get this episode out before before the next one. So you received an award recognizing you for your teaching and your work with students. And I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about kind of what is your kind of your philosophy or your approach. Like what is it that you seek to bring out in students or particular ways for them to develop? Like what's inside that teacher brain?
I think that for me, my sort of philosophy or pedagogy of teaching really surrounds like student-centered learning and thinking about the students that come into my class as individuals and allowing to give them room to find ownership and agency within the work that they're doing. Whether that's giving them choice in what they're creating or choice in the scripts that they're working on or choice in different, you know, like assessment rubric elements. Those kinds of things I think are important to how I teach. I think also you know, especially as I'm teaching third and fourth year classes, it's about trying to find the, like, how teaching becomes mentorship. And so, you know, essentially my hope is that they'll need me less and less, and that they'll continue to grow and be taking the foundations that they've been building while they're here, and then start to be able to find their own voice. So yeah, I would say that for me, relationship is very important, which I think is something that with the small class sizes that we have here in the dramatic arts, we can really achieve. Where, you know, if I was teaching a 400 student, you know, psychology or biology lecture, you wouldn't have that same opportunity. So, I mean, I always make it really important that I'm accessible to my students for conversations outside of class, and which, you know, might seem like kind of a normal thing or a basic thing, but I think that here, you know, I very much live in my office, and students are coming by all the time, and they're talking to me about things that have to do with the work or maybe extend past the work. And so yeah, I think that just being available, and looking at students and getting to know students as individuals, is really important. I think that, you know, some of the techniques that I use just start with, like, who are we in the room, and what are we all bringing to this, you know, ensemble that we're working in. Working in collaborative and ensemble methodologies, I think, is also, you know, a pretty large part of how I like to work. I mean, we've got like an ensemble of 16 actors, you know, plus 3 stage managers and, you know, a number of other folks. And so part of that is trying to explore, well, how can we all come together and feel valued and feel like our voice has importance. And so one of the things that I've been really exploring this year is the nature of gratitude. And so looking at, you know, at the end of a long rehearsal, coming together and talking about something that we're, you know, thankful for. We might say, like, you know, this was something that you did earlier today, and I was really thankful for that. And remembering that we're coming to the work as humans, we're coming to the work as people, and how we need to be thankful for the opportunities that we have, and we have to, you know, express that. You know, sometimes when I express gratitude, it starts to propel, right? It starts to propel that enthusiasm and energy and encouragement. And so yeah. I think that's kind of, you know, that's something that I've been exploring this year at least.
And gratitude is so powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you get into dramatic arts and into teaching? Was there a particular moment, a particular person or influence? Or did you just kind of find things kind of drifted that direction and went with it and pursued it?
I mean, when I was in elementary school, I was like, you know, goofy and playful and made my parents and sister laugh at the dinner table. And so I always knew that I liked to play. And then when I went to high school, like, drama, you know, became one of the things that I just fell in love with. You know, I was in most of the school plays while I was in drama. And then I went to university to be a high school drama teacher, which I did for a number of years. And then decided that I wanted to further my learning in directing. So I went and did my master's in directing, and that just, like, cracked open everything. Mm-hmm. And that's when I went to Italy and trained in this style of mask training and worked as a professional director for a little while. But I was always, like, balancing, like, professional directing with teaching, and teaching at, like, from 7-year-olds to, you know, all the way up to adults. And so I think that when I left teaching high school, I knew that I wanted to, if I was gonna teach, I wanted to end up teaching, you know, at post-secondary. And so, yeah, that was kind of like a journey, you know, as everybody experiences, I'm sure, except for the really lucky ones who stumble into a tenure track position. But
I'm not sure that happened, to be perfectly honest.
I was imagining that, you know, but yeah, you know, so I did, I taught, you know, sessionally at the University of Calgary for a little while. I did a fellow at Mount Allison University. And then I lucked into this job, and have been really thankful for that. So
how long have you been here?
So I've been here, it'll be 9 years in July.
So yeah. I'm trying to think, have you always been in this beautiful facility?
Yeah.
Yes.
So
So for the listener, we are recording in Mike's office, which is in the very stunning Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts.
Yeah.
Which is fast coming up on its 10th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And beautiful purpose-built facility. We'll put some links in the show notes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically I came like right as the building was opening. So I've been very lucky. I mean, the spaces that I sort of grew up in theater were always dark and dungeonous, sort of basements without windows and all of that kind of stuff. So we're very lucky to have, you know, beautiful wood floors in the hallways and bright, spacious studios. So,
and there is a great theater that can be configured multiple ways.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, some great studio and exhibition places as
mm-hmm.
well. So, yeah. Wonderful. Is there anything that we haven't talked about yet that you want to bring up or expand on?
I would say that, you know, going back to the show, we talked about mask and we talked about the nonverbal component of it. But I think one of the things that's really wonderful about the show is that we're kind of melding mask and physical theater and also movement, which for some folks will feel like a, you know, like dance. And so going back to sort of the interdisciplinary nature of this work, I think that that's one of the really beautiful parts of it, is that we're using the body not just to transform into character, but to transform into the brain and into atmosphere and mood and all of that kind of stuff. So I think that we've got this really lovely chorus that sort of moves and transforms in and out of the different scenes. And I think that's one of my favorite parts of the piece.
Well, we will look out for it. So listeners might find the links in the show notes.
Great.
And I wish you all the best with it. Do we still say break a leg?
You do, yeah.
All right, break a leg.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Forward. Find our footnotes, links to more information, transcripts, and past episodes on our website, brocku.ca/humanities. We love to hear from our listeners, so join us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at @brockhumanities. Please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting app so you don't miss an episode. Forward is hosted and produced by Allison Innes for the Faculty of Humanities at Brock University. Sound editing is by Serena Atella, and theme music is by Khaled Amam. This podcast is financially supported by the Faculty of Humanities at Brock University.